I look around the confused faces staring back at me. What is wrong with these people? And you call yourself football fans, I scold the two older men. Don Meredith was one of the greatest quarterbacks Dallas ever had. He played all 9 seasons of his professional career in Texas and led them to their first winning season. Everyone stares at me like I've just grown horns. Clearly, little blonde girls rarely spout sports history for them at the dinner table. Come on, guys. You're Green Bay fans. You have to remember the Ice Bowl. Finally, comprehension lights up their faces. That game is so famous, almost anyone their age has to remember it. I remember now, Charlie says, chuckling. And I'll admit defeat on the grounds that I didn't recognize the name immediately. Your father, and his daughter for that matter, are far more knowledgeable on the topic than we are. They all chuckle, and I smile happily at having proved my superiority on the topic. Vivian asks Max about her current course load, and Max launches into a tirade about one of her idiot professors. I glance up to smile at one of her particularly colorful descriptions and find Brody looking at me like I'm some unknown species. After our last confrontation, I know I should ignore that look, but I can't seem to stop from wondering what he's thinking. There are so many questions I could ask, but the one I whisper is, why do you look so confused? He stares a second more, then leans in a little, like he's going to tell me some kind of secret. He pauses, struggling for the word. Unexpected, he says finally. I'm momentarily surprised, but I recover quickly and grab for some sarcasm, wrapping it around me like a shield. Well, I suppose that's better than silly, I whisper, so as not to be overheard over the other conversation, but I refuse to drop eye contact with him. He doesn't even have the grace to look embarrassed or guilty. Is it now? I can't tell if he's actually trying to piss me off, but he's succeeding marvelously. It is, I try and match his tone. Unexpected could turn out to be a lot of things, but being described as silly, beyond the negative connotations, implies that you somehow already figured me out. Can I offer you some advice? He asks sardonically. No, I reply with equal sarcasm. I don't think my ego can handle your advice twice in 1 week. Brody's face brightens in surprise, and then, the stoic, pompous executive, whom I've never even seen crack a full smile, throws back his head and laughs. It's so incongruous with the person I've come to know that I'm actually startled by his response. A quick glance around the table tells me that this is just as shocking to the rest of the group, because they've all stopped to wonder at the sound, as if it's a new one for them, too. That pie really was so good, I tell Max as I look out at the LA night slipping past the passenger side window. I know. You've said that 3 times since we got in the car. I don't turn towards her, but I know she keeps looking at me every time we stop at a light. Did you use Baker's chocolate for the filling, or... Max's dramatic sigh cuts me off. Cut the crap, Landon. Just ask. Her words are a little harsh, but her tone is resigned. I spin towards her, unleashing my excitement for as long as she'll allow it. You have to explain it to me, because honestly, I can't even imagine. How can you be from your family, but you choose to bartend in order to afford our crappy apartment in Hollywood? Max doesn't look at me, but she does answer. They paid for school, because that seemed fair to me. But I've done everything else on my own since I was 18. When she stops speaking, I prompt her. Because? My dad built the company from the ground up, and both Liam and Brody are partners now. It sucks a little for them because their last name is Ashton, so everyone assumes they just inherited their jobs, but that's not true. They both earned their places. And now you want to do the same. She shakes her head slightly. I don't really know if I want to work with them, but whatever I do, I want to earn it on my own. It drives my mom crazy. She's positive my chances for gang rape increase by large increments every mile I live past La Brea. But they're so proud of you, anyone can see it. This most definitely makes her uncomfortable. She sort of flinches. I guess, whatever. Max, I grin at her even though she won't look my direction. You're kind of awesome. Her only response is a scowl, but at least I know she's heard me. After a few minutes, she breaks the silence. Coconut, she says succinctly. Excuse me? Coconut milk. In the pie. I use it to melt the chocolate down into the filling. Ah, that explains it. Chapter 12. Shut the front door! Mika screeches dramatically and then throws herself down into Quaid's old chair with the grace of a drunken toddler. Sayla's never mentioned getting a second assistant since the Volturi left, so the chair's only purpose now is to hold Mika when she comes calling. I'm guessing Sayla's figured she's getting two assistants for the price of one, so she's not motivated to bring in anyone else. With so many things to manage, Mika was right about my salary. If I ever divided it by the amount of hours I spend working, I wouldn't be shocked to discover that I could make a better hourly wage at In-N-Out Burger. It's the God's honest truth. I wouldn't have believed it if I hadn't seen it myself. I smile down at the reports I'm sorting and stapling on my desk. I knew she'd love this bit of news. This is... Sayla's line buzzes and our conversation pauses so that I can answer, then take a message. The second I hang up, Mika carries on. This actually explains a lot if you think about it, Mika says contemplatively. I look up from the papers in my hands. How so? Max, I mean. She acts all aggro-nation, but she's intelligent and even sweet when she wants to be. And she can wear all the sloppy, weird outfits she wants, but that kind of flawless complexion is achieved only through a lifetime of expensive facials. And her hair? You think someone at Fantastic Sam's cut that? I guess not. I really don't know. Mama's second cousin Terry works at a Fantastic Sam's, and she's pretty good at a spiral perm. I'm guessing she could cut a pixie if anyone in Texas would ever ask for such a thing. There's no question. Her highlights are so subtle they look like they were painted on by fairies. I should have realized. I'm actually surprised I didn't think of this before. But even if you had guessed, would you ever, in your wildest dreams, imagine who her family is? Definitely not. Mika has found a paperclip and is bending it into a new shape between her fingers. But then, I don't really know much about Brody besides the few times I've seen him at SSE stuff. And then Sayla's clinging to him like a bad suit because she... Miko's eyes snap up from a now straight piece of wire in her hand. She won't like this. I frown at her. She won't like that you have a connection to him outside of work. I just know his sister. It's not a big deal. It will be for her. She doesn't play well with other kids, and she doesn't share anything in any capacity. If she finds out you're friendly with what she thinks is hers... We're not friends. I barely know him, and even if she finds out I was there... You mean, if she finds out you spent a holiday with her would-be boyfriend and his family and she didn't? Mika challenges. Well, I guess she might not like that, but... No, Landon, seriously. She's irrational, and as far as I can tell, she's got sociopathic tendencies. One time, an intern brought her the wrong salad during an offsite, and she berated her so harshly, the girl threw up in a trash can out behind the venue. That's not true, I giggled nervously. It is true. She asked for sautéed shrimp, but I accidentally brought her sautéed chicken. I've never been able to go back inside the grill without getting a little nauseous, she says with a wink. Even though she's teasing, my face falls a little. I don't doubt for a second that her story is real, and that Sayla's reaction was over seafood. Miko's right. Sayla won't like me having been at the Ashtons for Thanksgiving. So make sure you have Sayla sign off on that Swarovski order by tonight, or we won't have them in time. Mika is suddenly all business. I look up at her confused. What is she talking about? Then Sayla's voice rings out from the doorway. Brinkley, are we confirmed for that tasting for Kessler Glen on Saturday? Yes, ma'am. I'm already whirling around to open up her calendar on my computer. Confirmed for an 11:30 with the caterer. You'll be there, too. And then afterwards, we're going for the final dress fitting. I look up, and my confusion must show because she only looks more annoyed with me. Did I stutter? She demands. Why is she so annoyed? Does she know? No, ma'am. I'm just surprised, but of course I'll be there. Sayla laughs, but there's no humor in the sound. No one is more surprised than me, but Kira wants you there. Whatever you assisted with this weekend must have made an impression on her. I don't need to remind you that you're there to be seen and not heard. You have to earn the right to interact with clients, Brinkley, and you're a long way from that. The brazen part of me wants to point out that my interaction with her clients saved her at the Riverton party, or that baking cakes with Kira while she chain-smoked and told me the entire saga of her relationship, complete with details that made my tender ears burn, would also be considered direct interaction. But as usual, I just nod. Sayla's eyes slide to Miko. Jen, surely you've got something better to do. She walks away before finishing her thought. Once we hear the door to her office close behind her, Miko gets up. Someday, not now, but someday, I'm going to go all Jericho Baron's inner beast on her, and it's not going to be pretty. She glares at the wall that separates us from Sayla's office like she can see through it. I spin back around in my desk so she can't see my face. It's more than a little embarrassing for your friend to see you get put in your place. I try to sound lighthearted when I say, I think you finally found a literary reference I don't get. Yeah? She asks, happy again. I'll give you the series. It's like 5 books of build-up, but when they finally get together, oh, so good. I'll see you later, okay? She asks from the doorway. I don't reply, just wave at her with papers in my hand. Sayla seems annoyed, but not hands-off-my-man annoyed, just general displeasure. Forget her bad attitude. It's really exciting to get to do something so personal with Kira. I've always wanted to work with brides on their wedding day, and this is the biggest bride and the biggest wedding ever. I can't wait. The Monique Lhuillier store on Melrose Place is sort of magical. When I walk inside, I have one of those breathless moments because the dress on the mannequin in the center of the room looks like something a princess might wear. It's the most beautiful combination of silk and lace, with a wide full skirt that would probably swish a little when you walk down the aisle. I'd say it's the most gorgeous dress in the world, but then there are similar gowns in every direction that are just as pretty. Being surrounded by this many gorgeous gowns has got to be every woman's fantasy, and I have no idea how a bride might choose between them all. May I help you? A well-tailored older woman comes over to ask. Yes, I'm here for the Meeks fitting, I tell her. This wedding is beyond high profile, and almost every detail is in code, including the names attached to the appointments. And you are, she asks kindly. Brinkley, from SSC. I'm meeting Miss Meeks. I smile back at her. Absolutely. They told me you were coming. Just wanted to check. She gestures for me to walk to the back. I'm escorted to the back room where Sayla and Kira's best friend Meg are already seated in fluffy white chairs sipping on champagne. I take a seat next to them and decline the attendant's offer for a drink of my own. I'm fairly sure Sayla wouldn't allow it, but I'm also too terrified to be responsible for any kind of beverage around this much expensive white silk. Sayla and Meg chat a little about some restaurant they both like, but when Kira emerges from the back room with the help of 2 attendants, we all lose the ability to speak. The dress has an empire waist with a low neckline and 3/4-length sleeves. The entire bodice is like a second skin and made up of delicate lace. The skirt looks like a fluffy pile of whipped cream that's been pinned up into itself here and there, and its volume only makes the dainty bodice look all the more delicate and feminine. She looks perfect. And once again, she doesn't even have makeup on. Oh, Kira, Meg sighs. It's stunning, Kira, really, Sayla tells her. Yeah? Kira asks nervously. It had a big bow here, she runs her finger along the waistline. But I had them remove it. It was a little much. Here are the 2 veils you were looking at, a perfectly tailored attendant says, coming out of the back room. She's got 2 veils in her hands. One is long and entirely lace. It's made to lay on the bride's forehead, completely covering her hair but not her face. The other is thin and sheer, but short, and attaches to the top of the bride's head. It's sweet, sort of like something you'd see in the 60s. Kira tries on one and then the other. And then she tries them on again. She goes back and forth, and both Sayla and Meg offer her polite opinions, but she's still undecided. Finally, after a 20-minute debate, she settles on the shorter option. Oh, thank God, Meg announces, rushing over to Kira. I've been sitting here praying you wouldn't choose the lace because I didn't want to have to tell you. You look like Mary Magdalene. Kira laughs at her. That doesn't even make sense. It does to me. That's all I could think of when you put it on. I expected Ave Maria to start blaring in the room at any moment. They hug and giggle, and I smile right along with them. Once everything is decided, and I have all the details from the attendants about delivery and so on, I say goodbye and make my way out of the store. I'm smiling as I go. This job sucks some days. Well, most days. But I've just spent the afternoon with a celebrity couple trying the most amazing food I'll likely ever eat. And now I'm walking through a field of dresses so pretty they almost hurt my eyes. Yes, some days this job sucks. But today is not one of those days. Chapter 13. If I thought a timeline for a mitzvah was intense, it was only because I'd never seen one for a wedding. The one in my hand is 16 pages at last count, and I'm following along as Taylor and the production team tell the room at large the details for setup. Kira and Jake are getting married at an old cathedral-turned-event venue downtown. I saw the space during the walkthrough, and it's amazing. But I can't help but feel a little weird about throwing a party on consecrated ground. I'm hoping, since Jesus' first miracle was turning water into wine, he won't mind the top-shelf bar or the 6 signature martinis we're serving during cocktail hour. Just want to confirm the strike time on this, I ask Taylor because I know that's the next question Sayla will ask. Midnight on this one as well, he says, with that boyish smile that's so incongruous with the rest of him. Does he always smile like that? Or is that look just for me? Can someone explain the cake thing to me again? Miko asks out of nowhere. I'm glad she said something because I don't really understand it myself. Jake's mother is making the wedding cake. Sayla pinches the bridge of her nose like the very idea gives her a migraine. Is she a baker? Miko asks the question everyone is wondering. No idea. She wanted to make the cake and I advised against it, but they're letting her. Are we going to do anything with that, or... Taylor asks. Allegedly, we're dressing the cake table per the design, and they, as in the MOG and some random aunt, are delivering it to the reception by 4. It's taken me weeks to decipher the wedding codes they all use. MOG is mother of groom, FOB is father of bride, and so on. And now that I understand it, I get a dorky sort of thrill when I use it, too. It's like speaking in wedding acronyms makes me more official or something. How odd. Holt speaks up, confused. I'm pretty sure it's the first time I've heard her talk in one of these meetings. You're from Wisconsin or something. What am I supposed to do? Sayla says, throwing her hands up. His family is actually from outside Chicago, but I don't correct her. I'm pretty sure all the states in the center of the country are the same to Sayla. Saturday at 4:42 p.m. is when I start to panic. Jake's mom was supposed to deliver the cake to the venue by 4, and there's no sign of her. I have her cell phone number, but after meeting her yesterday at the wedding rehearsal, I'm hesitant to call. Kira wasn't lying when she said Mrs. Kessler hated her, but I don't think she should take it personally. I'm pretty sure Mrs. Kessler hates everyone. It's hard to believe such an uptight woman gave birth to someone as dreamy and sweet as Jake. I attach another seating card to a chain of Swarovski crystals and move on to the next. It's taking a while to put together this vignette, since the chain and the custom clips to hold the cards in place are both delicate, but it'll be worth it. When guests enter the reception, they'll come through hundreds of crystal chains of various lengths dangling from the ceiling. It feels like you're walking through a wall of rain, and the effect is only heightened by the blue lighting and the pin spots our team is using to highlight the crystals. It's stunning, even if the effort to achieve it is pretty tedious. 30 minutes later, I finish the last of 207 seating cards, and I've decided I'm going to have to call the grouchy MOG. Guests arrive at 6, and the cake table is set up in the foyer, so they'll see it as they walk to the ceremony. I can't risk her being late and throwing off arrivals. As I pull out my phone, the far doors open, and Jake's mom walks into the room. She's wearing a black dress with an ill-fitting matching jacket and flat black shoes. It's like she actually tried to look as miserable as possible while still in formal wear. She holds the door open, and Taylor walks through it with a cake in his hands. I'm being generous when I call the thing Taylor's holding a cake, because even from a distance, it resembles a multi-tiered lump more than anything close to a wedding confection. Taylor heads my direction, and since the MOG beside him can't see his face, he looks at me and mouths a pretty distinct cuss word. For lack of any idea of what else to do, I smile brightly and meet them at the cake table just as Taylor sets his burden down on it. "Hi, Mrs. Kessler. This looks great." I go for a bold-faced lie. Crud. Surely lying isn't bad in a situation where telling the whole truth would hurt her feelings. Because the whole truth is that while there are four tiers and they're roundish, the cake is falling and sagging and in some places about to collapse completely. I know enough about baking to realize she iced this thing when it was still warm because the icing is full of red crumbs. And that's it. No piping, no flowers, no fancy scalloped edge, just red speckled icing on a troglodyte cake for the most well-publicized wedding of the year. Crap. Whether she was already coming over, or she smelled fear and responded to it like a shark, Sayla appears at the table next to me. "Look how gorgeous," she croons to Jake's mom. "This is stunning." I'm beginning to realize that stunning is Sayla's go-to word for everything. "That baby is stunning. Your dress is stunning. Did you see the rash on my arm? Stunning." Miss Kessler's thin-lipped mouth purses further, like she's just daring us to call her out on this monstrosity. Who would offer to bake their son's wedding cake if they didn't actually know how to bake? "Thank you. I think they'll like it," she says finally. "Kira wanted red velvet, which I think is sort of tacky in a wedding cake, but I did it just the same." I glance at Sayla, who's still smiling like this is the prettiest thing she's ever seen. How the heck are we going to deal with this? Mrs. Kessler won't acknowledge that the cake is an obvious disaster, so we're supposed to just display it? "Taylor, would you mind showing Jane where everyone else is? We're just about to start family pictures," Sayla says smoothly. As soon as they're out of earshot, she spins around to me. "You need to fix this right now." Gone is the calm, collected wedding planner. Now she's all wide-eyed, crazy town staring me down like I'm the one who made this lump on the table. Should I call someone or maybe order another? "No, you can't call someone. You can't offend her by replacing the cake. But you will find a way to make this look better." "But I don't have time for this. I'm supposed to be with the bride, not here figuring things out for you." She looks down at her phone. "You have 40 minutes. Then she turns around and walks away. For a moment, I just watch her go. What does she think I can do with this thing? Surely she'd be better equipped to deal with this sort of emergency. "Left you with cleanup, right?" Taylor asks. I hadn't even heard him walk up. "Yes, but I don't know what she thinks I can do." I look between him and the cake anxiously. "You don't get it yet, do you, Brinks?" He's called me that little nickname ever since the Riverton party, and it doesn't annoy me at all anymore. Sayla never gets her hands dirty with any of this. She doesn't dream it up or design it. She doesn't do setup or cleanup or anything else. And when something like this happens, he points down to the cake, she gives it to staff. Then if it goes to hell, she always has someone to blame. "But that doesn't make sense." I look back at the door where she just walked out. "If she doesn't do anything, how is this company so successful? How does she have all these clients?" I didn't say she wasn't smart. She knows enough to hire good people. The rest was just family connections and a deep trust fund. But if she doesn't know what to do in this sort of situation, how is she supposed to teach me? As if he's read the question on my face, Taylor steps closer and puts a reassuring hand on my arm. "Maybe you can call Jen. Maybe she'd have an idea." Miko left for San Francisco late last night after setup to make it home for her mom's birthday. I don't want to bug her, especially if I'm not even sure she can help. After all, it's not like this sort of thing happens all the time. No, we're tight on time, and I've got to figure this out myself. Think, Landon, think. We just need some way to make it look better, I stare at the cake intently, hoping the answer will magically appear. We could cover it with a sheet, Taylor says sarcastically, because that's about the only way it's going to look better. A disguise. That's it. I look around frantically. Taylor looks with me, confused. What's it? But before I can even answer him, I see what we need. It's a crazy idea, but maybe people will think it's avant-garde. Taylor, how much of that Swarovski do we have left? I say, staring at the vignette in the entryway. Taylor looks with me. An understanding darkens his face. We have plenty. But damn, Brinks, that'll take forever. We've got, I look at my phone, 32 minutes. Taylor runs out to grab what I need and is back in less than 2 minutes. God bless him. I grab for the first strand, but he stops my trembling hand before I reach it. When I look at him, his face is serious. Brinkley, promise me. If we make it out of this night alive, you'll go out with me. I can't help but laugh at his acting skills as he winks at me, which calms me down enough that my hand stops shaking. I grab the first string and begin working frantically to wrap the long chain of crystals in neat rows on the cake. I'm careful to cover up every tiny inch of the icing that holds the gems in place like glue. SSE staff come up and murmur to each other behind me, but I don't even acknowledge them. My stomach is churning, and the crystals keep sliding through my fingers because my hands are sweaty. I finish the cake just before the first guest walks through the door. I quickly shove my supplies under the champagne-colored linen of the cake table where no one can see them, and step back to look at the Frankenstein wedding cake. The lighting team has washed the table in amber and used pin spots to make the entire cake shimmer. I hate to use Sayla's word, but I will. It looks stunning. I'm sweaty and still fighting my nerves when I turn to go help with the ceremony seating. I have no idea at the time, but the image of this cake will get a whole page in People's coverage of the wedding. Because of the massive press exposure, bejeweled cakes will become one of the hottest wedding trends of the next season. And Sayla, of course, will take all the credit. The ceremony is almost full, which according to the rest of the team is sort of a miracle considering we're only 15 minutes late on our start time. I check in with the non-denominational minister, who has charged more than my rent to be here today, and then head back to Kira's dressing area. I want to see if Sayla needs anything else before we start, but when I walk in, I sort of wish I'd stayed out front. Sayla and Meg are looking on nervously, and Kira's pacing the room mid-rant, looking like the most frantic but beautiful bride I've ever seen. She's so pretty, I'm momentarily stunned, but then I see how hard she's fighting tears. I have to stop myself from rushing over and giving her a hug. I don't, Meg. I really don't know. Maybe it was just a silly thought. I fancy him and he fancies me, and so he thought to ask me to marry him because, you know, that's what his people do. But I? That's not what my people do. Kira keens before turning to Meg, who automatically holds up the cigarette that's lit in her hand. And Kira leans over, careful to keep her dress away from the ash, and takes a long drag off of it. My people, she says, whirling away and continuing to pace, drink too much and fight constantly and tell their kids what cock-ups they are. My people are the bloody poster children for divorce. What do I know about marriage or being a wife? I've only seen the very worst examples. Calm down, Kier. You're lovely and Jake loves you. Meg tries carefully. I wonder how long they've been back here trying to talk her down from the ledge. You have to say that, Kira says desperately. You're my best friend. Kira takes a deep, dramatic breath and seems to come to some sort of conclusion. No, I don't think I can do this to him. He convinced me to marry him, and I will never forgive him for that. But I cannot ruin his life. I won't do it to him. She looks at Sayla. You have to tell him that I... Her voice breaks and she starts to whimper. That I can't do this. I look at Sayla, who's calculating her next words, carefully measuring, I'm sure, what a cancellation of this wedding would mean for her reputation. And I know what will happen next. I've seen this scene 1,000 times in the wedding planner. It's the moment when Sayla will deliver a rehearsed speech she's crafted to perfection. It'll have the perfect amount of sincerity and romantic words to calm the bride and get her down the aisle. Kira, take a breath, doll. Sayla steps over to her, looking all calm and cool. There are 200 people out there waiting to see you in this gorgeous Luvier. Not to mention the press coverage of both this and the honeymoon will be ruined if you walk away now. It'll be disastrous for you. Let's get you some champagne. At this, she snaps her fingers at me, and I hurry over to fill a flute with champagne. You can take a moment to calm down, maybe have another cigarette, and then just get through today. It's not like you can't get divorced later. Kim did it after, what, 3 months? And now she and Kanye have the baby, and her profile's bigger than ever. You just need to get through today. She says it emphatically as I hand over the champagne. It's the least romantic speech I've ever heard in my life. It actually makes me a little sick to my stomach. Is that all this day is for them? Just another opportunity for press? Kira takes a big swallow of the champagne, and when she speaks again, her voice is small and sad. I really am sorry about all of this, but I can't do it. I won't do that to him. He'd end up hating me, and I couldn't ever handle that. At least this way, he could, I don't know, maybe move on or something. Tears slide down her cheeks, and without thinking, I step forward and grab her hand. She and I both stare down at our joined hands for a moment, surprised. Kira, I don't know you and Jake well, but I know without question that you love each other very much. No, you know what you've seen on TV and in the magazines. I'm a very good actress. She sounds jaded and sad, but she's holding onto my fingers like a lifeline. No, I know what I've seen in you. How hard you worked on Thanksgiving to make it special for him, even though you didn't know how to bake. And then at the tasting, I've never seen a man so excited to plan a wedding before. And I don't think he let go of your hand once. And he gave you all the tomatoes from his salad before he even took a bite. He knows I love tomatoes, she says, sniffing. And he laughed at all of your jokes, which, please excuse me for saying so, really weren't that funny. She's right, Kier. Your jokes are terrible, Meg pipes up helpfully. Oh, sod off, Kira tells Meg weakly. But for the first time since I walked in, she smiles a little. She looks back at me. I know he loves me, but I still can't marry him. I'll ruin everything. It's in my DNA. I don't know what I'm talking about here, or if I'm saying the right thing. I only know that she's upset, and so I tell her what I'd tell my very best friend in the same situation. I don't believe that. I squeeze her hand emphatically. It sounds like your parents didn't have a good marriage, but you know what? Mine do. They've been married for 32 years, and you've never met two people who are still so in love and happy. It's possible to have a great marriage. It just requires some effort. But I've seen you two together, and I believe you both care enough to put the effort in. But he's so great, and I'm such a mess. My mama always told me that grace is giving someone the opposite of what they deserve. I know I've never been married, but I think that means that sometimes he's going to have to let you get away with being a mess, and that sometimes you're going to have to let him get away with, well, whatever he does that bothers you. That creepy collection of Dune figurines might be a good place to start, Meg says, handing Kira Kleenex. Kira twists up the tissue nervously in her fingers. You think that I should do it then? She looks me dead in the eye, and a small part of my brain cannot believe this woman is asking me, a relative stranger, whether or not she should make such a huge decision. But I don't even hesitate. I think if you love him, and he loves you, that you shouldn't let what happened with your mama and daddy affect your decisions now. I think you say a prayer and take a leap of faith. And if you fall, well, now you'll have a husband there to help pick you back up. I smile at her, and I'm completely sincere. After a few more tense seconds, she smiles too. Full out, gorgeous bride on her wedding day, happy smile. And I know I've succeeded. Apparently, Sayla does too, because she snaps back to it. Brinkley, call hair and makeup back in so we can have a quick touch-up before we head to ceremony. Yes, ma'am. I hurry to beckon the beauty team back inside, and then watch as they quickly restore Kira's hair and cover up the lines the tears have made in her foundation. I feel a light pinch on my elbow and look up at Meg. "Well done, you," she whispers with a smile. Saying thank you would feel a little odd, since it was far too intimate a moment already, and my interference could have just as easily backfired. So I don't respond. I just smile back, and then slip out of the room to make sure the best man has the rings, before lining up the men in their positions. Later that night, after a beautiful and extremely emotional ceremony, the first dance during which Kira and Jake giggled like grade schoolers, and the near-inappropriate speech that Jake's little brother made after one too many of the specialty martinis, I'm able to sneak back to the kitchen and swap some food from the caterer. Dinner has long since passed, and all the kitchen has to offer is a hodgepodge of random appetizers and unclaimed vegetarian meals. Everything is cold and rubbery, but I haven't eaten all day, so I dig in like it's my last meal. It is here where Selah finds me, crouched over a busser's tray, smearing butter onto my second sourdough roll. I'm leaving now. She holds out a white envelope, like the object is personally offending her. Kira asked me to give you this. I lick a dab of butter off my finger. There are no napkins, and it's either that or wipe it on my dress, and I reach out to take it from her. She watches me intently while I open it, which makes me more than a little nervous. I don't know what I'm expecting, but it's certainly not 5 crisp $100 bills. I don't understand. I look to Selah for an answer. It's a tip, she says annoyed. But that's a ton of money. I didn't even really... She likes you, Selah says imperiously. Brides are emotional, and actress brides are the absolute worst. For whatever reason, you were able to calm her down. I suppose this is her way of thanking you. You should feel honored. Assistants don't usually get tipped. Oh my lord, I stare down at the money in my hand. $500 cash is huge. Maybe not for someone like Selah, whose shoes probably cost twice that much. But for someone like me, it's a cushion, a safety net. For me, this $500 is time. A little more time to keep living in L.A., more time to keep reaching for my dream. Thank you so much for letting me work on this with you. I learned so much today, I tell her sincerely, because I really have learned more in one single day of working a wedding for SSE than I have in years of assisting random planners back home. Even though none of the knowledge has come from her, I'm still grateful. Selah turns to leave, not deigning to reply, but then she calls out as she walks out the door. You did well today, Brinkley. She says it sort of begrudgingly, but she said it. It is the first time, for all I know, the only time ever, but Selah Smith has just given me a compliment. Chapter 14. Wait. Is this one for this week's party or next week's? I can't keep them straight. One of the designers on Miko's team waves a sketch dramatically in the air in our direction. We are all huddled around desks in the design team area long after quitting time, because we have to finalize the details of 6 separate holiday parties that have popped up on our radar out of the blue. Miko says it's typical for our corporate clients to hold out until the last minute before deciding whether or not to have their parties. But the end result means all of us scrambling to try and fit everything in before Christmas. That one is for next week, I say, pointing to the paper being waved at me like a flag. Remember, they wanted the tropical theme. Right, you're right. The designer studies the picture. They're all starting to run together in my mind. She rubs at her eyes, desperate. Jen, you've got to call it. It's almost 9, and you know I'm incapable of dreaming up anything pretty after 7. Miko and I both laugh. All right, fine. Why don't you guys take off? We'll finish up in the morning, she tells her little crew. The small group packs up eagerly and hurries off towards the elevator, infinitely more animated now that they've been given a reprieve. You don't need to stay either, she tells me. I look up from my laptop where I've been adjusting proposals and inputting numbers into bid sheets, to go along with their design schematics all evening. Actually, I don't mind. I need to finish these proposals anyway. I look down and keep typing. Writing proposals isn't even part of your job. She looks at me suspiciously. It's not my job, but it's important that I know how. I've told her this at least 3 times today. I guess, she mutters, looking back down at her sketch. We both work a few more minutes in silence, and then she stands up. Come on, we're taking this on the road. She sandwiches her pencil in between the pages of her sketch pad and throws the whole thing into her shoulder bag. Where are we going? I ask, but I'm already packing up my laptop to follow her. I need food, more specifically, orange chicken. Don't have to tell me twice. I follow her like a dutiful puppy as we jog across the street to grab a table at Chin Chin. We immediately set up our work on the corner table we are given, but it isn't quite as tedious now that we're both munching on fried wonton strips and sipping the first fruity cocktails we spotted on the menu. I think I'm tapped too, she says as she looks up from her sketch and takes a big sip of her drink. 6 designs in 1 day is a little much, even for me. My phone buzzes with a text message and I grab it. Is Max gonna come meet us? Miko guesses who my text is from. Doesn't look like it. She's still fighting that flu, and she says she's too exhausted to leave the couch. I read the text aloud. Miko looks confused, and I understand why. I don't think either of us has ever heard Max admit weakness. Did she work tonight? Not sure, but she's been working a ton lately and writing her thesis nonstop. I'm sure she's just worn out. I drop the phone back into my bag. The waitress comes over and sets down our assorted pleasures dim sum, and I reach for a piece of gift-wrapped chicken. Just like always, I burn my thumb on the hot foil wrapping when I try to open it. Which one are you working on now? Donahue, Capel, and Michelson. You'd think a bunch of lawyers would be okay with access to an open bar and the musical stylings of whatever cheesy cover band they book every year, but they're pretty big on the design. She pinches a pot sticker with her chopsticks. What was the direction? Miko sorts through the piles of paperwork in front of her before finding the scrap she's looking for. She reads her notes to me. Elegant but unique, whimsical without being gauche. Not very specific, are they? Not this client, no. I'm just trying to think of something we haven't already done. I stab the last morsel of chicken on my plate. What about an Asian theme? Point around the restaurant with my fork. Miko looks at me like I've just suggested vomit as a decor inspiration. Landon, that idea is long dead, and the time of death was somewhere back in 2001. Also, nobody does overt anymore. It's all about subtlety in a theme or a statement in an element. Can you translate that for the new kid? I stare at her confused and take another sip of my cocktail. It's like this. You either have a sort of underlying theme that guides your hand with the decor, maybe the type of flowers or the colors you use, or you have some big impact, a statement piece at the party, and everything else is just there to help show it off. Okay, I get it. Let me try again. I look around for inspiration, but the decor in the restaurant is sort of nondescript. I give up and go back to my cocktail, hoping it will offer some insight. As it turns out, what about this? I hold up the little red drink umbrella. You're kidding, right? Drink umbrellas are beyond cheesy. Not the drink umbrella, dummy. What about regular umbrellas? I saw a wedding once in a magazine where they hung painted Japanese parasols upside down from the ceiling, and it was really pretty. I hold the little umbrella upside down to illustrate the point. Miko considers it a moment. I feel like someone did an art installation like that a few years ago. They were all the same color, I think. I open my laptop and Google for a better example of what she's talking about. The page fills with various pictures of the example she's mentioned. Red umbrellas hang open, upside down, and create a canopy down the middle of the street. The effect is striking. I spin it around to show her. Could this be your statement element? Miko looks at the screen intently, and I start babbling to further support my theory. I mean, the ceilings in the ballroom are really high, so maybe you could, I don't know, create a trail of umbrellas that kind of float there. You could light them from above so they sort of glow, and the rest of the lighting and decor could be subtle, so it's like the whole party sort of wraps around under this magical little canopy. She smiles at me with a bemused expression on her face. What? I ask nervously. Is it terrible? It's chic, It's different. It's impactful without being too expensive. Her expression turns into a full-blown grin. Hot damn, intern, you just designed your first party. I laugh loudly, thrilled that she likes my idea. We start brainstorming other ideas and different ways to set up the space to best highlight the design. Once we get the layout nailed down, we celebrate this milestone in my career by splitting the last vegetable spring roll. Chapter 15. So this is Runyon. I look up at the steep dirt trail snaking up the mountain in front of me, then back over at Taylor. He's dressed for the excursion in black basketball shorts and a gray Henley that's pushed up on his arm, showing off his tattoos. I'm doing my very best not to mock his OU ball cap because, with the level of wear and tear on that thing, it's clearly cherished. I've never been hiking, so when he asked me to come with him, I had to make a guess about my own attire, which resulted in workout pants, a sweatshirt, and my running shoes. This is Runyon. He starts up the hill, and I hurry to follow him. It's Saturday afternoon, and the day is pretty chilly, but the trail is covered with people, hurrying up and down the mountain like ants. So this is what you do on your weekends or whatever? Why do I sound like such a 13-year-old? Sometimes, he says, and smiles over at me. I actually brought you here because it's a popular LA activity, and you're still looking for those, right? Several members of the SSE team know how excited I still am to be in a new town, and they're always quizzing me on what I've done so far. They've made it their mission to guide me through the experiences they say are thoroughly LA, and the ones that are just for tourists. I am, I grin at him. So this is a cool thing to... I stop short as a guy jogs past us with his dogs. Was that Justin Timberlake? I hiss at Taylor. Brinks. He grabs my shoulders and turns me to face the right direction again. The only thing busier than the best Hollywood club on a Saturday night is Runyon on a Saturday afternoon. We walk for a few minutes in silence, and the incline increases with each step, reminding me how long it's been since I hit the gym at my apartment. How did you end up at SSE? I ask him, between gulps of air. I came out here a few years ago after school to work in production, in movies. Not parties. I had some different PA gigs, but the money was terrible, and you're never guaranteed hours. I got a part-time gig working events for the guy that used to have my job. He left to do his own thing, and I got bumped up. He points out a hole in the path for me to avoid and continues. Working for Sayla would never be my first choice, but the money's pretty good, and that's a priority for me right now. Ah, driven by the almighty dollar, I tease him. Nah, it's not like that. I got a kid sister in her freshman year of OU, and a single mom who'd have to work two jobs if I couldn't help her out. He shrugs nonchalantly. My face falls. I feel like such a jerk. I had no idea he was helping support his family back home. Oh gosh, Taylor, I'm so sorry I opened my big mouth. I had no idea you were... He gives me a self-deprecating grin. Come on, Brinks. I'm not a martyr. I'm 27, and there isn't really anything I want that I can't afford, and I'm able to help my family out, too. The job sucks some days, but the check's always clear, so it's good enough for now. What about you? What about me? Why are you here? As if we had timed it perfectly, we come to a spot on the trail without trees or brush, and the whole city is laid out below like a quilt. It's so grand and inspiring that I'm a little breathless when I finally look back over at Taylor, who's watching me. I'm here for this. I grin and open my arms to encompass the view. I came for this. I start laughing, so overwhelmed by the spectacular sight before me. He chuckles and throws his tattooed forearm around my shoulders and pulls me back towards the trail. Come on, Brinks. You're too easily impressed. I haven't even tried that hard yet. Really? I ask. His arm falls off my shoulders, but he's still so close that our shoulders keep brushing each other as we hike. Really? He looks over and smiles at me, and even under the brim of his tattered cap, he looks like a pirate or a marauder on the cover of every romance novel I've ever read. When I actually try, you'll know it. Is he flirting with me? Oh God, he's flirting with me. Of course he's flirting with me. He probably thinks this is a date. Why am I so naive? I just thought, hey, calm down. He bumps me with his elbow playfully. I brought you hiking, not to an orgy. I'm a perfect gentleman. What are you talking about? I'm terrible at schooling my features, and God only knows what he's just seen flash across my face. Taylor makes an inarticulate sound and throws me a look that says he knows I'm full of it. I want to act cool, but now I'm just uncomfortable. I'm not sure how to feel about him or what the rules are for accidentally going on a date with your coworker. His voice breaks into my internal debate. See, this is why I saved the orgy for date number 4. Girls can rarely handle group activity this early in a relationship. I look over at him in shock, and he's grinning at me. All the tension leaves my shoulders, and I stop right there on the dusty trail and laugh until my sides hurt. Pirate or not, Taylor is one of the most fun people I've met in this town. 1 week later, I'm standing under a canopy of at least 100 red umbrellas lighting up the breathtaking room before me. We're 15 minutes from guest arrival, but I allow myself the small moment to look up at my tiny idea come to life. For the first time since starting this job, I'm really, really proud of myself. I'm still grinning as I turn to head across the ballroom to check on the wine delivery at the bars. That smile freezes on my face when I see Selah laugh her way into the ballroom, side by side with Brody Ashton. This hotel is one of Barker Ashe's biggest luxury properties, so I knew I might run into him, but I'd been really hoping to avoid it. Seeing him walk with Selah in her skin-tight red Prada dress, chatting in her client voice, only serves to remind me that I'm not supposed to know him at all. I'm a little sick with the idea that he might mention Thanksgiving, and that she might use the opportunity to rip my head off and turn it into a purse. Curl mouth at corners, raise up towards cheeks. There. I hope whatever is on my face will pass for a smile. I walk towards them to check in with her and see what she thinks of the space. I'd pitched the idea for the installation at an all-hands meeting, and it was met with a quick approval, which in Selah world is apparently a huge coup. Regardless of how nervous I feel, the installation looks amazing. And ever since I've gotten my one tiny Selah compliment, I've been itching to see if I could impress her again. This looks incredible. I'm sure they'll be pleased, I hear Brody say as he peers up the umbrella installation. My umbrellas look incredible. And this from a guy who's incapable of a compliment. Well, you wouldn't expect anything else from me, would you? Selah says in her gross, overly flirtatious voice, and my heart stops. Did she just say, how did you come up with the idea? Brody looks back overhead. I've never seen anything like it. She considers the umbrellas for a second, which is as long as it takes her to come up with the lie. The painting by Cipolla. I've always admired his work, and it came to mind when I was dreaming up a theme. Dear Lord, she just lied her way through that entire sentence with the poise of a senator's wife. Worse still, I don't even know what painter she's talking about, so I'm not even smart enough to refute her claim. Here I am, hoping she might give me some small scrap of a compliment, and she's not even going to acknowledge my participation at all. I wonder, not for the first time, if she even realizes she's lying, or if she just does it so often that she believes it simply because it came out of her mouth. I've only just walked up to them, but I make up an excuse to leave. If you'll both excuse me, I try to keep my voice steady. I just need to check in with the catering captain on a wine delivery. I make to walk away, but Selah stops me. While you're at it, check in with operations and bring the thermostat up a bit. It's freezing in here. She does a mock shudder and scoots closer to Brody in some weird pantomime of snuggling up close to get warm. Any idiot could tell her, a large ballroom is always cool, but once it's filled with 400 drunk lawyers, it'll be too hot, and then it'll take ages to cool it down again. But I'm not that idiot, so I just nod. Brody steps away from Selah and directly into my path. This is a really bad idea for all parties concerned. I look up at him with questioning eyes. I'll walk with you, Landon. I need to check in with the captain myself. It is a totally casual comment, but I know Selah won't like him leaving her side to go anywhere with me. That is what worries me, until I realize what he's just said. Please, Jesus, Mary, and the saints, did he just call me Landon? I glance quickly at her, Maybe she didn't catch him using my first name. Nope. No, she definitely caught that. I'm a goner. Probably, yes, Mr. Ashton, if you'll... I glance nervously at Selah, then back at him. Excuse me, I have to... I don't even finish the sentence, because Brody looks utterly confused by my response. When I look at Selah, she's looking back and forth between us like she's trying to solve a particularly difficult riddle. And then I see it. It's the moment she decides something is up. Her eyes narrow, and suddenly she's not looking at me like a worthless peon. She's looking at me like I'm an adversary, which is far more terrifying. I have a single crazy moment when I consider screaming, "Nothing is going on, I swear!" But I bite my tongue. There's an intense, quiet moment in which Selah glares. I stare at my shoes. And Brody checks his phone, like he's got 97 better things to do than stand here in this tableau. I wait for the blow-up, but to her credit, she doesn't scream, or fire me, or say anything terrible. No, like only the very best villains, she attacks subtly. Brinkley, I need you to pick up my dry cleaning, she says abruptly. I guess she's trying to embarrass me in front of him, which, in the grand scheme of life, isn't as bad as I expected. Of course, I'll add it to my list. I turn to go. No. I need you to go right now. Right now? I look around me confused. We're about to open the doors for a huge party. Yes, I have two events to attend this weekend, and I need more wardrobe options. I need you to go pick up the dry cleaning and drop it off at my house. But the event is... Selah smiles, and it's pure evil. Surely you don't think the absence of one little assistant can in some way negatively affect an event. Honestly, we've managed to get along just fine for the last 5 years without your help. Of course not, but I just thought... But I don't pay you to think, do I? Her eyes spark maliciously. And right now, I'm paying you to go pick up my dry cleaning. Brody turns back to her and inserts himself into the conversation. Honestly, Selah, you need her to go to the west side during rush hour on a Friday. All three of us can hear the annoyance in his voice, and I want to curl up and die right there on the plush ballroom carpet. Why is he picking this, of all moments, to be chivalrous? Doesn't he know this is only going to make it worse? B. Are you trying to tell me how to run my company now? Selah says coquettishly. Her body language is flirtatious, but her eyes glitter with a challenge. I lower my eyes. I can't look at her, and I definitely can't look at Brody. I don't have any choice, and she knows it. My job is whatever she says it is, and right now, that's running errands. I nod and turn to go grab my bag, and she throws her last pass. Mia's leash is on the hook by the door. Be sure and run her around the block while you're there. You know she hates being cooped up while I'm out. I don't acknowledge the statement, but then I don't really need to. She knows I'll do it. I spend the next hour and a half sitting in terrible traffic, trying, yet again, not to cry. I was so excited about this event. It was the first one I'd worked on from start to finish, and I'd helped plan every single element. From the design down to the dessert choices. I'd wanted to hear what the clients thought about everything. Wanted to see people's reaction to the umbrellas. Umbrellas inspired by a cheesy cocktail garnish, not an old painting. Ugh. I'm not gonna think about it. I'm gonna do what she's asked of me and head back over. With any luck, I'll be back in time to hand out the gift bags we spent 3 hours stuffing. I park my car in front of Selah's 24-hour, eco-friendly dry cleaners and hustle inside. An older man is sitting in front of a portable TV, and when he sees me, he hops up. Hi, Mr. Agabalian. How are you doing? I slip up to the counter. I just need to grab whatever she has in-house. She has more? He looks confused. Let me check. He scoots over to the ancient computer and clicks through for a bit, but his confusion only grows. I'm sorry, I don't see anything in here. Are you sure? Oh, I'm sure. She sent me all the way over here to grab whatever it is. Do you think she dropped off something else? I was here when she picked up that red dress and a few blouses this afternoon, but I don't see anything else in the system. Maybe she brought them in when I was at lunch, and Ava hasn't put them in the system yet. He looks up helplessly. I'm already pulling out my phone to text Selah,